The House and Senate will return Tuesday and stay in session through Friday. Last week in the House came back on Wednesday and voted to pass two bills under suspension of the rules, including a bill to turn over from federal control to the control of the District of Columbia government the campus that encompasses the Robert F. Kennedy Stadium, where the Washington Redskins used to play football. On Thursday, the House passed three more bills under suspension, including H.R. 7463, the Extension of Continuing Appropriations and Other Matters Act, also known as the Continuing Resolution. We'll talk more about that in a moment. And then they were done. This week in the House will return on Tuesday with the first vote scheduled for 6:30 p.m. At that time, the House is scheduled to consider 13 bills under suspension of the rules. On Wednesday and Thursday, the House will consider H.R. 2799, the Expanding Access to Capital Act of 2023, and H.R. 7511, the Lake and Riley Act. On Thursday evening, the House will host Joe Biden for his third State of the Union address. In addition, the House will likely be voting on appropriations legislation, about which we will talk more in a moment. Last week in the Senate came back on Monday and voted to invoke cloture on the nomination of Jacqueline Becerra to be U.S. District Judge for the Southern District of Florida. On Tuesday, the Senate voted to confirm her to that position. Then the Senate voted to invoke cloture on and then to confirm the nominations of David Seymour Leibovitz to be U.S. District Judge for the Southern District of Florida and Hampton Y. Dellinger to be Special Counsel in the Office of Special Counsel. On Wednesday, the Senate voted to invoke cloture on and then to confirm the nominations of Julie Simone Sneed to be U.S. District Judge for the Middle District of Florida and Melissa Damian to be U.S. District Judge for the Southern District of Florida. Then the Senate voted to invoke cloture on the nomination of Marjorie A. Rawlinson to be Chief Counsel for the Internal Revenue Service and an Assistant General Counsel in the Department of the Treasury. On Thursday, the Senate voted to confirm her to those positions. Then the Senate voted to sustain the veto cast by President Biden when he rejected S.J. Res. 38. That was a Congressional Review Act resolution of disapproval of the rules submitted by the Federal Highway Administration relating to waiver of Buy America requirements for electric vehicle chargers. Then the Senate rejected, by a vote of 13-79, a motion to discharge S.J. Res. 60 from the Committee on Foreign Relations. That resolution was a resolution providing for congressional disapproval of the proposed foreign military sale to the government of Turkey of certain defense articles and services. Then the Senate took up H.R. 7463, the Extension of Continuing Appropriations and Other Matters Act, also known as the CR. First up was an amendment offered by Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul to establish prohibitions relating to the purchase or sale of state or municipal securities. The amendment was defeated by a vote of 37-53. Then Kansas Republican Senator Roger Marshall offered a motion to commit the bill back to the Committee on Appropriations with instructions. That motion was defeated by a vote of 14-76. Then Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee offered another motion to commit the bill back to the Committee on Appropriations with a different set of instructions. That motion fared no better and was rejected by a vote of 12-77. Then, because bad things always happen in threes, Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz offered a motion to, you got it, commit the bill back to the Committee on Appropriations with yet a different set of instructions. That motion fared better than either of the previous two, but also went down to defeat by a vote of 32-58. Then the Senate voted on passage of the CR, and it passed by a vote of 77-13, and then they were done. This week in the Senate will return Tuesday with the first vote set for 5:30 p.m. At that time, the Senate is scheduled to proceed to a roll call vote on cloture on the nomination of Ronald T. Keohane to be an Assistant Secretary of Defense. Then, based on the Majority Leader's cloture filings, I anticipate we will see votes on the nominations of Moshe Z. Marvit to be a member of the Federal Mine Safety and Health Review Commission, and Kathy Ann Harris to be Chairman of the Merit Systems Protection Board. And, of course, the Senate will at some point take up whatever appropriations bill or bills come out of the House. We'll talk more about that in a moment. Now to the Senate leadership. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who took over the leadership of Senate Republicans in 2007 following the disastrous 2006 midterm election cycle, and has served longer as the leader of his conference than any Senate leader in history, announced Tuesday that he would step down from his leadership position following the 2024 elections. That means that in mid-November, during freshman orientation, Senate Republicans will choose from among themselves a new leader. Utah's Mitt Romney and Indiana's Mike Braun will not vote in that election because they have declared their retirements from the Senate at the end of this term and will not serve in the next Congress. On the other hand, we could have several new Republican senators who will be allowed to vote in the leadership election because they will be serving in the next Congress. For years, we've known of three likely competitors for the leadership after McConnell. They're called the Three Johns: John Cornyn of Texas, John Thune of South Dakota, and John Barrasso of Wyoming. Cornyn served two terms as party whip and served a term as chairman of the NRSC and has given a ton of money to his colleagues over the years. John Thune is serving now as party whip and is close to McConnell. And John Barrasso serves now as conference chairman, the third ranking position in leadership after the leader and the party whip, and is closer to many of the conservatives in the conference. Others who may be interested in running include Florida's Rick Scott, who challenged McConnell for his position at the start of the current Congress, and maybe Montana's Steve Daines, who serves this cycle as chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee and may help elect as many as six or seven new Republican senators. Daines may be former President Trump's choice for the position. We've got an eight-month leadership contest to look forward to. I cannot remember the last time we had a leadership contest that lasted this long. Stay tuned. Now to the border crisis. Joe Biden's border crisis now has two names and two faces to go with it: Laken Riley and Jose Antonio Ibarra. Laken Riley is the name of the 22-year-old female nursing student who was murdered while out for a run on a wooded trail near the University of Georgia's Athens campus on Thursday, February 22nd. Jose Antonio Ibarra is the name of the 26-year-old Venezuelan illegal immigrant who's been captured and charged with her murder. Ibarra entered the country illegally in September 2022, according to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. He was captured by CBP and released into the country after being held briefly. He was then arrested in New York City a year later and charged with reckless endangerment of a child and behaving in a manner injurious to a child, along with motor vehicle charges for driving an unregistered, uninsured vehicle. He was released before ICE could serve a detainer on him and made his way to Georgia, where in the fall of 2023, he was arrested for shoplifting $200 worth of material from a Walmart in Athens. But he apparently skipped his court date because there was a warrant out for his arrest when law enforcement authorities picked him up and arrested him on Friday, February 23rd. Remember those two names, Laken Riley and Jose Antonio Ibarra, because you're going to be hearing a lot of those two names over the next 8 months. Just a few days after Laken Riley's murder, the Gallup organization released a new survey showing that immigration has surged in the last month to become the most important problem facing the country. Last month, 20% of survey respondents said that. In the new survey released last Tuesday, 28% said so. Immigration has now passed the government as the most often cited problem. The two answers were tied for the top spot at 20% each for the months of January 2024 and December 2023. For the 11 months prior to that, from January to November 2023, the government ranked first each month. The last time immigration was listed as the top concern in a Gallup poll was 5 years ago, in July 2019. On Thursday, Joe Biden did something he's only done once before as president. He traveled to the southwest border for a photo op. It was an odd photo op because the advance staff decided to send him to Brownsville, Texas, where there were no illegal encounters recorded on Monday and only 34 in the first 3 days of the week. It was almost as if the White House wanted Biden to say, "See, there's no problem at the border. What are you talking about?" Trump, on the other hand, went to Eagle Pass, Texas, 350 miles up the Rio Grande. There, between February 25 and February 27, there were 1,273 illegal immigrants encountered. 3 days. And no one knows how many unknown gotaways. The split screen on MSNBC's Morning Joe Friday was hilarious. There was Biden by himself doing that oddly stiff walk from one place to another, while on the other side of the screen there was Trump surrounded by people as he pressed the flesh. It was a metaphor for the entire campaign so far, and it did not look good for Team Biden. Now to the Mayorkas impeachment trial. The House was only in session for one day last week. Consequently, the House did not send to the Senate the articles of impeachment against Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, and no action was taken on the impeachment trial. Nevertheless, reporters continued to ask around to try to figure out how Senate Majority Leader Schumer would address the issue. They reported that he was strongly considering moving a resolution to dismiss the case as soon as the last senator was sworn in as a juror. That is, he would allow all 100 senators to be sworn in as jurors, as is the procedure, and then he would immediately shut down the trial even before the House impeachment managers have the opportunity to present any evidence or make any argument. Many Senate Republicans, including both Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and Minority Whip John Thune, have declared their support for a full trial. We talked last week about a letter led by Senators Lee and Cruz that had 13 signatures on it, urging McConnell to support a full trial. Since then, other Republican senators have declared their support for a full impeachment trial. They include Katie Britt of Alabama, Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, Steve Daines of Montana, and John Cornyn of Texas. Now to the latest on the emergency supplemental, that is, aid to Ukraine. Just like last week, there's no movement to report on the emergency supplemental spending bill, also known as the foreign aid/national security spending bill. President Biden invited Speaker Johnson to join Biden and the other three leaders of Congress at the White House in an attempt to pressure Johnson to fold, but as of the end of the week, he still has not committed to putting that bill on the floor. Instead, it appears likely that another bill, slightly smaller, will get to the floor via a discharge petition. Now that New York Democrats have won back the seat in the 3rd District that was vacated when Republican George Santos was expelled from the House, the partisan breakdown in the House is 219 Republicans and 213 Democrats. So if all Democrats sign a new discharge petition, it would take 5 Republicans to sign it to get to 218. We have not seen such a discharge petition yet. We'll keep our eyes peeled. Now let's talk about government funding. Last Wednesday, the 4 congressional leaders, 2 in the House, 2 in the Senate, announced that they had come to agreement over the top-line spending levels for 6 of the 12 appropriations bills: military construction, veterans affairs, energy and water, agriculture and rural development, transportation, housing and urban development, commerce, justice, science, and interior environment. Once they had agreement in hand, it greased the skids for a vote the following day to give themselves an extra week on the funding front. So they passed a new continuing resolution that extended the bills that were supposed to expire March 1 to March 8. And they extended the bills that were supposed to expire March 8 to March 22. The second tranche of bills, including defense, labor, HHS, education, homeland security, financial services and general government, state foreign operations, and legislative branch, is where the bulk of the money is and where the toughest negotiations will take place. Appropriators and their committee staffs were tasked with writing the bills to the numbers agreed to by the top congressional leaders. They were hoping to have final text ready to be released Sunday so the House could maintain its 72-hour rule and still vote Wednesday before everyone's attention turns to Thursday's visit by President Biden to the chamber to deliver his State of the Union address. And then, as if by magic, appropriators announced on Sunday afternoon that they had finished writing all 6 bills in time to allow the House to have 72 hours to read everything before they'll have to vote on the bills Wednesday. Senate Majority Leader Schumer said in a statement that the bills have no cuts or poison pill riders, that is, changes to current policy that were sought by conservatives in both chambers. Now to the latest on the Trump indictments. Two major updates on the Trump indictment front. First, in Georgia, it looks like Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis and Nathan Wade, the man she hired to serve as her special prosecutor in going after Donald Trump and his colleagues, who also is her former romantic partner, may be in a heap of trouble for having lied to the judge about when their relationship began. The judge had a private talk with Wade's former law partner and then heard testimony from the former law partner in open court, and none of it was good for Willis and Wade. After hearing the testimony he did, the judge said he'd try to have a decision within the next 2 weeks. Second, the Supreme Court gave Donald Trump a gift by agreeing to take up his appeal on the question of whether or not he enjoyed presidential immunity for his actions in the White House. The court scheduled oral arguments for the week of April 22 and likely will issue a ruling by the end of June. Obviously, that means the trial will not begin as scheduled. It was originally scheduled to begin this week, and consequently, we now know that of the four different criminal prosecutions facing the former president, the first one he will go to trial on is the worst of all the cases, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's truly ridiculous case against Trump for false bookkeeping. Now let's talk about the 2024 elections, the latest. The left is going crazy again. Maureen Dowd, the official voice of the left-wing establishment, wrote in her Sunday New York Times column about the dream she recently had, in which she dreamed that Joe Biden announced at the State of the Union address that he would not run for re-election after all. What's got them in a tizzy now? Well, there are two new polls out that came out this weekend. Saturday was the New York Times Siena College poll, and Sunday was the Wall Street Journal poll. Neither one had any good news for Biden. The New York Times Siena College poll was first and was worst. It showed that Trump had a 5-point lead over Biden at 48% to 43%. It wasn't the policy differences that are killing Biden, it's his age and perceived mental acuity. To the statement, "This candidate is just too old to be an effective president," 21% said they strongly agree, and 21% said they somewhat agree about Trump, for a total of 42%, against 55% who disagreed. But about Biden, fully 47% said they strongly agree, and another 26% said they somewhat agree, for a total of 73% who agree with that statement. Worse, in the crosstabs, we can see what people who voted for Biden in 2020 think now. And we see that 61% of those who say they voted for Biden in 2020 now say he's too old to lead the country effectively. The Wall Street Journal poll was a bit better for Biden. It showed him trailing Trump by just 2 points at 47% to 45%. Worse were the battleground state polls. Bloomberg released the survey midweek. It was taken in seven key battleground states: Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Overall, the survey shows Trump leading Biden by 5 points at 48% to 43%. In Arizona, Trump leads by 6 at 49% to 43%. In Georgia, Trump leads by 6 at 49% to 43%. In Michigan, Trump leads by 2 at 46% to 44%. In Nevada, Trump leads by 6 at 48% to 42%. In North Carolina, Trump leads by 9 at 50% to 41%. In Pennsylvania, Trump leads by 6 at 49% to 43%. And in Wisconsin, Trump leads by 4 at 46% to 42%. In other campaign 2024 news, a Cook County Circuit Judge in Illinois last Wednesday overruled the state's Board of Elections and knocked former President Trump off the Illinois primary ballot, largely basing her decision on the ruling by the Colorado Supreme Court that Trump had taken part in an insurrection and was therefore not qualified to serve in office. Judge Tracy Porter said that Trump had not been truthful when he said he was qualified to serve as president and therefore could not be listed on the ballot. In related news, the Supreme Court ruled this morning that the Colorado Supreme Court had no idea what it was talking about, and that the state of Colorado was wrong to bar former President Trump from the 2024 Republican presidential primary ballot. In light of the fact that Colorado is one of the 16 states that will hold its presidential primary on Super Tuesday, tomorrow, that ruling is well-timed. The court held that, quote, because the Constitution makes Congress rather than the states responsible for enforcing Section 3 against federal officeholders and candidates, we reverse, end quote. Justice Barrett concurs in part and concurs in the judgment. She agrees that states do not have the power to enforce Section 3 against presidential candidates, but would not go further and address whether federal legislation is the only way that Section 3 can be enforced. Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson, the three justices appointed by Democrat presidents, have an opinion concurring in the judgment, agreeing that Colorado may not throw Trump off the ballot. But then, they say, five other justices go further and, quote, decide novel constitutional questions to insulate this court and Trump from further controversy, end quote, by announcing, quote, that a disqualification for insurrection can occur only when Congress enacts a particular kind of legislation pursuant to Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, end quote, and they don't agree with that. The ruling is not just well-timed, it is also well-reasoned, and it should put to bed any thought by anybody on the left that they're going to knock Trump off the ballot in either the primaries or the general election, or even after the election, on the basis of an incorrect reading or application of the 14th Amendment to Trump and the January 6 riots. Now to the Jenny Beth Show. Episode 55 of the Jenny Beth Show dropped last Wednesday. It's another short but sweet episode featuring her interview with Matthew Martinez at Turning Point Action, recorded at the Restoring National Confidence Summit in Las Vegas, Nevada. The two discussed Turning Point Action's plans to move low-propensity Republicans to the polls. Highly recommended. And that's our Washington Report for this week.